This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Pleasure to enjoy another day of this excellent symposium. And over the next 15 minutes or so, I'm going to review the pharmacology of antithrombotic therapy as it applies to management of the vascular surgery patient. I'm going to discuss the timing of discontinuation and reinitiation of antithrombotic therapy in the vascular surgery setting, especially as it pertains to the non-vitamin K oral anticoagulants. And then I'm going to highlight strategies for management of antithrombotic-associated bleeding in the vascular surgery patient. So antithrombotic therapy is a cornerstone of management of patients with cardiovascular disease, whether it's for venous disease or atrial fibrillation. The non-vitamin K oral anticoagulants really has represented a major advance over warfarin for stroke prevention in atrial fibrillation and for treatment of venous thromboembolism. The issue is that limited experience with the NOACs has really resulted in a lack of consensus for the management in the perioperative setting. So really can't discuss anticoagulation without focusing at least for a little while on warfarin. We know that warfarin has some distinct advantages. It's cheap. It's proven the test of time. But what we spend most of our time thinking about are the disadvantages, things like the delayed onset and offset, the variable dose response, this observation that we can have a patient who's 280 pounds, young football player who only needs 5 milligrams of warfarin, and then you can have an 80-year-old, 100-pound woman who needs 30 milligrams of warfarin per day. You can't look at someone and pick the dose. There's a narrow therapeutic window. It's not unlike trying to hit the center of a dartboard. If you can keep patients between 2 to 3 for an INR, you're in good shape, but as you deviate out of that, you place the patient at risk for adverse events. There are many drug-drug and drug-food interactions, and it's inconvenient to monitor for both patients and providers. And truth be told, there's a substantial bleeding rate every year that a patient is on warfarin. Here we can see that dartboard phenomenon for managing patients on warfarin. We try for most indications to keep patients between 2 to 3, and if we can keep them there, it's an efficacious therapy. The issue is if we drop below 2, we place patients at risk for thrombosis, and when we exceed 3, we place them at risk for major bleeding, in particular intracranial hemorrhage. Because it's so difficult to manage patients with warfarin, there's been an incredible interest in the non-vitamin K oral anticoagulants and really widespread adoption. Compared with warfarin, these NOACs have a rapid onset. Within a few hours, patients are fully anticoagulated. The dosing is much easier. It's really a fixed dose for the vast majority of patients. There are very few drug-drug and drug-food interactions. You don't need routine laboratory monitoring. And the half-life is short, so if a patient comes in bleeding, if their last dose was over 12 hours ago, you're actually already seeing the anticoagulant effect wearing off. When it comes to reversal agents, although we have ways of reversing warfarin, there's always been this knock against the NOACs that there aren't antidotes available. Well, now I can say that Pradaxa, which is dabigatran, has a very effective antidote called Praxbind or idrisizumab. And for the direct 10A inhibitors, there should be an antidote available within the year. When we look at these NOACs for stroke prevention and atrial fibrillation, we see something that nobody thought could be true, that there would be a class of agents that actually are more effective than warfarin for preventing stroke or systemic embolism. But in all of the major randomized controlled trials of these NOACs, we see a reduction in stroke over what's achieved with warfarin. And in most of the trials, we see that it's at least as safe, if not safer, than warfarin, especially for prevention of the worst complication, bleeding complication, which is intracranial hemorrhage. And here we can see in meta-analysis the enhanced safety of the non-vitamin K oral anticoagulants. You can see here substantial reductions in intracranial hemorrhage and overall reductions in major bleeding associated with the NOACs. For venous thromboembolism, likewise, the NOACs have really been an advance forward for our patients. Although they're comparable to the vitamin K antagonists, they provide a substantial benefit with huge reductions in major bleeding, clinically relevant non-major bleeding, non-fatal intracranial hemorrhage, and fatal bleeding. Where they present a real clinical challenge is management of these NOACs around procedures. One of the interesting observations from these pivotal landmark randomized controlled trials is that there was a concern when the NOACs came on the market that there would be more bleeding and more risk of thrombosis around the time of invasive procedures. An analysis of the RELY trial, which was a study looking at dabigatran for stroke prevention and atrial fibrillation, showed actually no such thing. There didn't seem to be any increased signal of thrombosis or bleeding compared with warfarin. Although complication rates are low for all of the NOACs across the board, the frequency of bleeding and thrombosis associated with this class of drug in the perioperative setting isn't negligible. Much like warfarin, there are going to be patients that are high risk for complications. What's really important and what seems to be lacking is familiarity with the pharmacology of these drugs, especially in the surgical setting. We don't really have comfort managing NOAC-associated bleeding as of yet, and it remains to be seen whether the more widespread availability of reversal agents will change this. Some important risk factors for us to keep in mind when it comes to perioperative bleeding with patients taking NOACs would be advanced age. Certainly many additional studies will need to be done to look at this, but initial subgroup analyses of stroke prevention and atrial fibrillation trials with the NOACs haven't conclusively shown increased risk, although all of the drugs have suggested reductions for advanced elderly patients. Renal dysfunction is a very important increased risk factor for bleeding in the setting of taking NOACs. Dose reductions have been recommended in moderate renal dysfunction. Very important is the concurrent use of antiplatelet agents. There is at least a twofold increased risk of bleeding when you use antiplatelet agents along with the NOACs, such that it's very important that we look at our patients' medication list and ask ourselves, do they need to be on antiplatelet agent if they're already on anticoagulation? Oftentimes, the answer is no, they do not. Another challenge for use of the NOACs is we don't have tests that can reliably predict the level of anticoagulation that a patient may have after taking a NOAC. The usual coagulation studies that we are used to using, such as the PTT or the PT, are relatively unreliable. There are some investigational techniques that can tell us if a patient has a NOAC on board and if they're anticoagulated, but those are not widely available. One of the key things for us to understand is that no matter which NOAC we're talking about, the half-life is in general under 12 hours. So for the majority of our patients, if they come in and they need emergency surgery or they're bleeding, if their dose was the day before, then we're able to proceed forward with treating their bleeding or with proceeding to surgery because there's no anticoagulant effect any longer. All of the manufacturers for the NOACs actually have in the package insert recommendations for how to interrupt the anticoagulant around the time of surgery. In general, it's thought that you can hold 2 days' worth of doses before elective surgery in order to proceed safely. There are many recommendations when renal function is impaired of holding the anticoagulant for even longer. Other considerations for managing the NOACs around the time of surgery is, especially as pertains to restarting the NOAC, you have to keep in mind the intraoperative blood loss, post-operative risk of bleeding, the post-operative risk of thrombosis, renal function, which sometimes can fluctuate in the post-operative setting, and the need for follow-up procedures. If you're planning to take a patient for a relook, you may want to hold off on reinitiating anticoagulation. Some of the recommendations, currently there aren't firm recommendations for when to restart the NOACs, but the majority actually suggest that you can do so within 24 to 48 hours after you achieve hemostasis. Some guidelines and some statements recommend resuming the NOAC at a half dose initially, at a prophylactic dose, and then when it's safe to do so, going up to the full therapeutic dose. Others talk about giving low molecular weight heparins in low doses before switching back to the NOAC. In general, we find that we're able to restart, for most patients, the NOAC at the full dose. Now I want to focus on management of antithrombotic-associated bleeding and emergency surgery. We can see here that the things that we're used to using for warfarin-associated bleeding actually aren't efficacious for the non-vitamin K oral anticoagulants. Vitamin K and FFP don't really have a role. What we have seen, preliminary data, small studies showing that four-factor PCC, which is now, we call that Kcentra, it's what is preferred for warfarin reversal, also can be used to reverse the effect of the NOAC. It's also important to recognize that dabigatran or Pradaxa can be dialyzed. Here we can see prothrombin complex concentrate used for reversal of rivaroxaban. Here we're looking at a patient that's been given rivaroxaban and then given prothrombin complex concentrate. We can see that the PT comes down promptly with administration of Kcentra. For dabigatran, a different formulation of PCC, you can see that it actually has little effect for dabigatran. In general, there's an alternative form of PCC called FIBA that you can use for dabigatran, but now that's really unnecessary because we have a reversal agent. Here's a study that looked at rat tail bleeding for dabigatran-induced bleeding. You can see here dabigatran's given, bleeding time increases, prothrombin complex concentrate is administered, and the mean bleeding time returns to baseline. Likewise, in the rabbit kidney bleeding model, same thing. If you give PCC, you can actually reverse this in the setting of dabigatran. But we're very fortunate to have specific reversal agents for the NOACs, some of which are FDA approved and some of which are on the way. The fact that these agents are actually direct inhibitors of coagulation gives us the opportunity to have direct antidotes. For dabigatran, we have itaracizumab, which is a fully humanized monoclonal antibody that's very similar to thrombin that's FDA approved. And also, under FDA review, is andexanet alpha, which is a recombinant modified human factor 10A molecule. There's another agent that's earlier in development called seropirantag, and that actually has the potential to reverse almost all of the anticoagulants that we have in our armamentarium. So here we can see dabigatran reversal with itaracizumab. The very interesting thing about itaracizumab is it's a monoclonal antibody fragment that mimics thrombin but has none of the catalytic activity of thrombin. So it simply binds with high affinity to dabigatran, but it doesn't affect coagulation, so you can't actually make a patient prothrombotic. You can't actually cause an MI or thrombosis with this, and that makes it more favorable than when we have to just replace coagulation factors because there's always the potential that we'll go overboard. We can see here in the pivotal study for itaracizumab called Reverse AD, in dabigatran, administration of itaracizumab as a double bolus very quickly reverses measures of anticoagulation like the thrombin time and eccrin clotting time. And it very rapidly eliminates dabigatran from the system. So based on these data, the FDA actually approved itaracizumab for reversal of dabigatran. It's given as 2.5 gram IV boluses, no more than 15 minutes apart, and is very effective. All of our centers should carry this in the pharmacy. For the direct 10A inhibitors, these are things like apixaban, rivaroxaban, edoxaban. There's this R antidote. It is a recombinant factor 10A molecule that is, again, catalytically inactive but binds with high affinity to the factor 10A inhibitors. So it takes them out of the equation without actually having its own effect on the coagulation. So you also can't make patients prothrombotic. Here we can see a schematic of how this works. In patients taking a direct 10A inhibitor such as rivaroxaban, rivaroxaban binds to the prothrombinase complex and inhibits it, so you can't convert prothrombin to thrombin. When you give this R antidote, it actually binds rivaroxaban with high affinity, it leaves the prothrombinase complex alone, and now you can convert prothrombin to thrombin. This has been studied in a number of trials, one of the most recent ones being Annexa 4, which shows that andexanet alpha given as a bolus and infusion actually is very effective at reducing the effect of the direct 10A inhibitors. So when it comes to an overall algorithm for managing the NOACs and patients who have severe or life-threatening bleeding or need emergency surgery, if you're certain that their last dose was sooner than 12 hours and you think there's still an anticoagulant effect, if it's dabigatran that they've taken, you can give activated charcoal if it's under 2 hours from the ingestion. You can also dialyze, but there's really no need to pursue dialysis now that we have idarucizumab, which works quite well. For the direct factor 10A inhibitors, we use four-factor PCC until we get andexanet alpha more widely available. Some of you may have clinical trials evaluating andexanet alpha at your center, and you can enroll patients in those trials to get access to it. So in summary, the short half-lives and enhanced safety of the NOACs compared with warfarin are likely to facilitate, actually, interruption of anticoagulation in the setting of procedures and bleeding in vascular surgery patients. Limited data and varying strategies for interruption of the NOACs presents a current clinical challenge, but as we get to using these agents with more experience, we're going to get more comfortable. As I mentioned, greater experience, the development of commercially available assays of NOACs activity, and the approval of reversal agents will likely dispel much of the uncertainty surrounding the management in the perioperative setting. Thank you very much.
I have a question before we go to the audience. So you mentioned that one should try not to combine a NOAC with aspirin, but they have different mechanisms of action. So can you?
Sure.
It seems there'd be many patient with stable angina who has AFib. Would you not need both?
No. So if patients have a solid indication for being on aspirin, they absolutely should be maintained on both. But when we see patients who have no known cardiovascular disease and are just on it because they heard it was something good to take, we should be responsible for actually removing it when it's unnecessary.
Greg, again, great information, really outstanding. I don't want to make you go too long, but maybe you could say a few words about some of the studies looking at NOACs, particularly in peripheral vascular disease and peripheral vascular intervention, some of the studies that we're waiting to hear about lower doses in peripheral intervention.
Yeah, so that's a very hot area of study right now. There have been studies evaluating. We even have, back in the warfarin days, looked at warfarin for the peripheral vascular disease patient. The hope is that these agents are actually going to really revolutionize the management of PAD patients. One of the things that comes up frequently in my clinic is patients who repeatedly thrombose grafts. Those patients may have some underlying pro-coagulant state, and these anticoagulants may actually play a key role. We've seen some agents that kind of skirt Realms of antiplatelet and antithrombotic agents like Vorapaxar actually have some role in the management of PAD patients. I think this is an area that we could stand to make a significant inroad in. We're all looking forward to the further trials to evaluate antithrombotic therapy for the PAD patient.
Thanks for all the information. That's great information. Just, I think I have available Octoplex, which is that 4 PP. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm just for reversing the 10A agents. I was told that the Octoplex is not really very good for that, and so my question is how good is it? And then if the Octoplex works, why doesn't FFP work? And just, I don't know, I cannot remember all the basic science.
Sure, no problem.
Just simply.
No, it's an issue because four-factor PCC's really not been the subject of robust randomized controlled trials for reversal of the anti-10A agents. Although in animal models, healthy volunteer models, and some small trials, it appears to be effective. It's not clear how much you really need to give. It's not as sure a thing as it is with warfarin. It's for that reason that we're really looking forward to andexanet alpha, which seems to do a better job of reversing the 10A inhibitors than PCC.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.